Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. Coming up on today's program, Pope on Christian Unity Week. Pope Benedict reflects on the theme chosen to mark this year's Week of Prayer for Christian Unity that began on Wednesday. Methodist viewpoint on ecumenical dialogue. We speak to the minister of the English-speaking Methodist Church in Rome about the ongoing ecumenical dialogue between the Catholic Church and the World Methodist Council. And East Africa update. We hear a report from a representative of Caritas Internationalis about her most recent visit to the drought-stricken Horn of Africa region and learn more about the current situation and progress that has been made to alleviate the humanitarian crisis. At his Wednesday General Audience, Pope Benedict reflected on the theme chosen to mark this year's Week of Prayer for Christian Unity that began on January the 18th. Chris Altieri reports.
Speaking to the thousands of pilgrims present in the Paul VI Audience Hall on Wednesday for his weekly General Audience, Pope Benedict XVI said the Week of Prayer for Christian Unity invites all the Lord's followers to implore the gift of unity. This year's theme, "We Will All Be Changed by the Victory of Our Lord Jesus Christ," was chosen by representatives of the Catholic Church and the Polish Ecumenical Council. The Holy Father said Poland's experience of oppression and persecution prompts a deeper reflection on the meaning of Christ's victory over sin and death, a victory in which we share through faith.
By his teaching, his example, and his Paschal mystery, the Lord has shown us the way to a victory obtained not by power, but by love and concern for those in need. Faith in Christ and interior conversion, both individual and communal, must constantly accompany our prayer for Christian unity.
Pope Benedict also focused on the need for all Christians to ask God for an increase of faith.
During this week of prayer, let us ask the Lord, in a particular way, to strengthen the faith of all Christians, to change our hearts, and to enable us to bear united witness to the gospel. In this way, we will contribute to the new evangelization and respond ever more fully to the spiritual hunger of the men and women of our time.
Pope Benedict had greetings as well for pilgrims in many languages, including English, in which he bade a special welcome to a pair of groups. One, an ecumenical delegation from Finland that traditionally makes the pilgrimage to Rome during the Week of Prayer for Christian Unity. The other, a group of men and women in the Naval Service and Marine Corps of the United States.
I offer a cordial welcome to all saints, speaking pilgrims and visitors present to this audience. My special greeting goes to the Lutheran pilgrims from Finland. I also greet the group of sailors and mariners from the United States. Upon all of you and your families, I call and invoke God's abundant blessings.
The Week of Prayer for Christian Unity has been celebrated for more than a century, each year from the 18th to the 25th of January. A Catholic convert, Paul Watson, proposed the dates in 1908 because they coincide with the traditional feast of the Chair of St. Peter and the feast of the conversion of St. Paul. I'm Chris Altieri.
As we heard earlier, Christians around the world are currently marking the annual Week of Prayer for Christian Unity. One of the oldest bilateral ecumenical dialogues that have been going on since shortly after the end of the Second Vatican Council is that between the Catholic Church and the World Methodist Council, This particular dialogue stretches back to 1967 and was described this week by Monsignor Mark Langham, a senior official at the Pontifical Council for Christian Unity, as a very warm and stable dialogue. The Reverend Ken Howcroft is the minister at the English-speaking Methodist Church in Rome, and until last year served as the ecumenical officer for the British Methodist Church. He spoke to me about what has been planned to mark the current week of prayer for Christian unity here in the Eternal City, and also gave me an assessment of the current state of relations between Catholics and Methodists.
The major event is that on the Sunday of the week of prayer, we are hosting at our Methodist Church the Churches Together in Rome service for the week of prayer. That is the English language churches in Rome, which form this organization called Churches Together in Rome. And we are holding that service at our church on the Sunday evening. Donna Ursuto, Catholic, the director of the lay center at Foyer Unitas, will be preaching. I will be presiding, and lots of other people from the other churches will be taking part.
And in general terms, how important for you is this annual event, this week of prayer for Christian unity, for all concerned? You mean, how much does it help to advance the ecumenical dialogue?
I think it helps a great deal. And I have been sad over a number of years now that the amount of praying in the week of prayer seemed to go down for a time, but it now seems to be coming back up again. I think it's really important that people pray together and that people meet together to pray together, which means we're with people that we don't normally pray with, and we encounter each other as people and as Christians and as fellow disciples. And out of that, all sorts of other initiatives then start to happen during the year.
The ecumenical dialogue between the Catholic Church and the World Methodist Council dates back to 1967, one of the oldest, I believe. And the most recent report on this dialogue talks of a growing mutual respect compared to what it called its rather strained and dismissive start. So in terms of perceptions of each other, should we say, has there been a big change in your view?
I think there has, and I also think these conversations have been immensely fruitful. They don't get as much publicity as, say, the Roman Catholic Anglican world conversations, but they're under the radar, as it were. But they've therefore made a lot more progress. And a Catholic friend of mine put it very well a number of years ago, I thought, and he said, when he talks to Methodists, we start off talking in different language and thinking we're opposed to each other, but we quickly discover we're talking about the same things. Whereas in some conversations, he said, he found he used the same language as people of other traditions, and it took them a very long time to discover they were talking about different things. And there are lots of similarities of outlook between some Catholic spiritualities and some Methodist spiritualities. So if I were to say that Methodist emphases are on the importance of the sacrament, the importance of evangelism, the importance of holiness, which is both personal and social, the idea of discipleship, which moves on towards sanctification, all those things, and the idea of being a disciplined church with its ministry moving under orders, those are things that actually we share. And a Methodist historian, an American called Albert Outler, once said that Methodism is like a lay order of Jesuits with a few ordained people to serve it. And there's a lot of truth in that.
The late Pope John Paul, who of course did a lot to try to advance ecumenical dialogue, he spoke of it often as looking at an exchange of gifts rather than perhaps focusing on the contentious issues. What would be the gifts that the Methodists would like to share with Catholics?
I mean, Methodists would classically be quite humble at this point and say, well, we've not got anything anybody wants. But actually, if we look with more confidence at our own tradition, we do have some really important things to share. One of them, which has been enormously well received by many of Catholics, are the tradition of hymn singing, and in particular the hymns of Charles Wesley and some hymns by John Wesley, but also within that, the Eucharistic hymns of the Wesleys are a real gem. Hymns which ask people singing them are praying their faith of the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist. And that is a huge gift from our tradition.
How much do relations between Methodists and Catholics vary around the world? Where, for instance, are they most cordial and close?
That's a very interesting question. They are very cordial in England, again, because of some of the history, in that for a long time, both Methodists and Catholics were excluded from universities and other such things because they weren't the established church. So they were both, in a sense, nonconformist in that context. And we have always got on well together. In America as well, I think there are quite good contacts. But over the years, throughout the world, the Methodists and Catholics have just gradually got on with things, doing what they can together and not bothering so much about the things that they can't do together.
Now, earlier I mentioned a report on the dialogue between the Catholic Church and the World Methodist Council. This report spoke of how good intentions alone are insufficient and that more concrete steps are needed. What would the Methodists see as the concrete steps they would like the Catholics to take?
I think we would like to see the Catholics taking further steps on a route they've already gone down. We've been enormously grateful for the moves the Roman Catholic Church has made to ecumenism on by talking about being on a journey as pilgrims together, as brothers and sisters in Christ together, and moving towards full communion with each other by a series of stages, doing what you can now, and then moving on to the next step beyond that. And we would really like to see the Roman Catholic Church moving further down those lines with us. And also, one of the more interesting questions that the Methodist Roman Catholic conversations opened up is about what, as we come back together, as we actually start to discover the unity for which Christ prayed and that Christ willed for his church, what would be, there would need to be a central focus to United Church, and what is the role of the Pope in that? And there have been conversations about that. Now, historically, these are really difficult for Methodists, but Catholic understanding has been such that actually we're able to start now having that sort of conversation.
So how would you say is the main then sticking point on this issue of papal primacy?
Well, going back to an earlier question, the gifts of Methodism, one of Methodism's gifts is an understanding that the oversight of the whole church is something that we, all the members of the church, participate in, and it is then focused in those who are ordained. So our equivalent of the Pope is the Methodist Conference. It's a corporate body. And that understanding of the corporate nature of oversight and primacy, which then has to be focused in individuals, matches a growing understanding in other traditions of how the authority of the individual is shared with corporate bodies. And that conversation could be really fruitful to bring the corporate and the individual together.
So overall, how hopeful are you about the future of the ecumenical dialogue between Methodists and Catholics? Do you feel that some real concrete progress is being made, or is it just more a case of increasingly cordial relations between the two, or just treading water?
Well, it's not treading water. It's making progress on some of the historical and theological problems, but it's opening up the possibility of things happening on the ground. And so Methodists tend to be pragmatic people, and they will actually accept all sorts of things that they haven't accepted before if it can be shown that the worship and mission of the church will be furthered by doing it. And practical steps on the ground are things that are happening in all sorts of different places now, things we do together.
Such as?
Well, I mean, again, my most recent, because I've only been in Rome since September, so my most recent knowledge is of the British context. But there are lots of things in the British context of, for example, people from Catholic and Methodist and other churches working as street pastors at night on the streets, encountering people who've been out drinking or out to the clubs or whatever, and offering practical help and concern to them as part of Christian witness and care for them. That is becoming a growing movement all over the place, and we're doing those things together.
I was speaking to the Reverend Ken Howcroft, minister at the English-speaking Methodist Church of Ponte Sant'Angelo in Rome. What is the current situation like for those living in the Horn of Africa and East Africa, where last year some 13 million people were threatened by famine as a result of drought and conflict? The grave humanitarian crisis there has slipped partly off the radar of the international community in recent months compared to the height of the crisis last summer. But the good news is that the number of people at risk of outright famine has been dramatically reduced, thanks to last year's massive aid program mounted by the UN and relief agencies. One of the aid agencies that were in the forefront of the relief operation was the Caritas Internationalis Confederation, who was able to assist around 1 million victims of hunger and drought in this region of Africa. Laura Sheehan is the communications officer for Caritas Internationalis and late last year visited three drought-stricken regions of Kenya, following on from an earlier visit by her to the nation at the height of the humanitarian crisis. I sat down with her today to find out more about the current situation.
Well, when I was there in July, the country was very arid. The areas I saw were extremely dry and I didn't see how anything could grow there. When I was there in late autumn, things were a bit better. There had been some rains in the middle of October. There were green shoots on the ground. There were, you know, the trees were putting out leaves. So if the people had not lost their animals, they could now, those animals could now graze and they could now grow crops.
A top UN official, though, has said that although the situation has now got better, there's not so many people threatened by famine, there is still a continued risk of famine in the area, that many people are going to remain in a highly precarious situation and are going to require continued assistance. Would you agree with that?
I do agree that the situation is very precarious. It's so hard to gauge the rains there. You just never know if they're going to come the way they used to come. And when you can't control the weather, and when people are so dependent on rain, both to keep their livestock alive and to grow crops, it's very difficult. It's a big concern.
Now, at the height of the famine in the summer of 2011, there were 13 million people said to be at risk of famine. What's the situation like now?
In the parts of Kenya that I saw, and based on reports we're getting from Ethiopia, things are better. Things are not great. You know, these families are very, very poor. They've basically lost their safety nets. For example, you know, if they had 40 goats in the past, they now maybe have 7. Those goats are what they sell when there's a medical emergency. They sell their goats to pay school fees so that their children can go to school. So when they don't have livestock, they really have nothing. The situation, in my opinion, is very precarious.
Now, how many people has Caritas been able to help directly or indirectly through its aid?
We've been able to help over 1 million people. So we've really reached out over very wide areas of East Africa. We've trucked in clean water. We've trucked in food. We've given out drought-resistant seeds. These are seeds that can grow in as little as 45 days. They can mature very quickly so that even if it rains, you know, just for a few days or for a week, in 1 month, you can perhaps harvest a crop. And we met people who were actually eating some of these crops that they had grown from the seeds we gave out.
when you went around and visited these various places you saw in Kenya, and you said that the north was perhaps the most difficult area, and when you talked to your local Caritas partners there, what were some of the anecdotes, the most striking anecdotes that really brought home both the gravity of the crisis back in the summer of 2011 and maybe how the situation is slowly evolving now?
Well, one thing I heard from a Caritas staff member in southern Kenya was he was at a Caritas food distribution and he saw a woman who was sitting down as she waited for her food ration. She was too weak to stand and she was crying. And he asked, you know, why is she crying? And she was crying because she hadn't seen so much food in such a long time. And she was crying because she knew she would finally be able to eat her fill. It had been so long since that had happened. So she was so grateful and just overwhelmed by this.
And is it true that the drought was so bad that at times there people couldn't even eat leaves, which of course had been a fallback in previous droughts?
Yes, exactly. In previous droughts, there would still be a few types of leaves, or there's even this one very tiny sort of coconut that used to grow that was sort of like the drought tree, as I understand. This drought was so bad that even that wasn't growing. So there were really no options.
And what sort of distances were many of these people traveling to get water as the drought began to bite harder and harder?
Well, Somali refugees would walk hundreds of miles to escape a drought situation and a conflict situation. Within Kenya, Kenyans would be walking hours and hours to get to a dry riverbed. And then the women, it's generally the women who collect the water, they would scoop and scoop with gourds through the sandy, dry riverbed to get down to any water at all. So they would, for example, walk 2 hours to get there, spend at least a half hour scooping and digging in the riverbed, and then 2 hours to get back carrying these heavy water jugs on their back. So it was, you know, at least half a day that they would spend. It's heavy work. It's hard work. Sometimes it's dangerous work. Sometimes the women would have to go even farther to a river that had crocodiles and hippos. Hippos are very dangerous, I found out. And sometimes people would be attacked by animals in these rivers where there was actually water flowing.
And lose their lives, presumably.
Yeah. One woman said her husband lost his leg, so now she had to do even more work because he was disabled. Another woman I spoke to, her sister's husband got killed.
By a crocodile?
By a crocodile. And they had 4 children.
Of course, as always happens, it's the young children who suffer most in these situations of drought and famine. And you were telling me earlier of a very disturbing situation that you were told by a bishop about how the disabled children were often treated.
Yes, I think in a lot of the developing world, there are attitudes towards the disabled that are problematic. Sometimes they're considered a curse, or I know that in Buddhist countries, sometimes when you have a disabled child, people say it's because you did something bad in your past life. In Kenya, unfortunately, what the bishop was saying was that a few disabled children were kept in the house every now and then, hidden, even maybe tied to a bed. In a famine situation, they would sort of be the last to be focused on in terms of food. And the bishop did say that some disabled children during this famine died of hunger while tied this way.
Another issue, which is perhaps not focused on in the height of a famine, is how it sets neighbours against neighbours as people compete for increasingly scarce resources. Can you tell us how this does impact in some of these communities in Kenya and how, with Caritas' help, you were able to, help overcome these rivalries?
Basically, when there's not enough water, people get desperate. And when they're watching their cattle die and their goats die, they become desperate. So what we were seeing a lot of times was cattle raiding, when there would be conflicts between farmers who grew crops and animal herders who wanted land to graze their animals on. So the animal herders would come farther and farther into territory that wasn't as affected by the drought. And the two groups would fight. They would fight with guns. They would shoot each other. One man I talked to said that poison-tipped arrows were used during one conflict. What Caritas is trying to do is bring groups in conflict together to work on water projects that will benefit all of them. So, for example, in one area of North Kenya, we brought 2 rival tribes together to work on sort of a pond or a dam digging this water source that they could both use. And it was really heartwarming to know that once they had finished this water project, not only did they all have water, but they celebrated together voluntarily. They decided that they wanted to celebrate what they had accomplished. It's very unusual for these two particular tribes to do anything together except fight.
But of course, despite the fact that the number of people now at risk of famine has dropped thanks to international aid, there are presumably still many children who are suffering from the effects of malnutrition. Did you see any of those directly during your visit?
I did see children who were severely affected by malnutrition. We saw one little baby boy who was severely underweight for his age. So what Caritas is doing is providing extra food rations for these small children and also for their mothers. If they're breastfeeding, the mothers need more food. And what we're doing at the clinics is we're making sure to say, you know, this food is for the baby and for the mother.
When you got to speak, presumably through an interpreter, with some of the people, what was some of the feedback that you got via your local partners that was particularly memorable?
One thing I heard from at least one priest was that people had really been collapsing by the side of the road. They were just so weak that if they were walking a few kilometers, they just couldn't make it. There was one elderly man that the priest remembered often seeing in this particular spot where we went. And apparently during the famine, he was incredibly weak. Through this priest parish, Caritas did distribute food to him and to many other people in that area. And it was really nice because when we were there in late autumn, this elderly man came walking out. He wasn't as weak as he had been.
Did you also, when you went around and talked to people and heard what at least they've been telling the local partners on the ground, that they felt that they could have died if help hadn't arrived?
One woman, a widow with seven children, said that if not for the Caritas help, they simply would have died. And there did seem to be many people who had been suffering from severe hunger. So I'm very glad that Caritas and other groups were able to get to them on time. That doesn't mean that we reached everyone, unfortunately.
So do you feel that overall the reaction of the international community to this famine, to this humanitarian crisis, really did help to mitigate the effects of it? It was a good news story, really, that people did come in and help. Or in other words, I could put it much more simply, how would you rate the response of the international community to this crisis, which of course was unprecedented in its scope, at least compared to the last half century in a way?
I think aid agencies are really improving. We're all working hard to get to people in need. Compared, for example, with the famine in Ethiopia in the 1980s, there was much less loss of life in East Africa this time around. We still need to work on things. There are early warning signs that we really need to pay attention to. Caritas has programs called disaster risk reduction, where we work with communities and where we see the first sign of trouble, whether it be drought or other calamities that could happen. We're working with them to say, you know, okay, what can we do? Should we build this special irrigation canal? Should we build this dam or this pond, you know, to get you water if the next rains don't come? So we have been working on that for years. We'll continue to do that and we'll continue to improve.
So it's basically all about prevention rather than cure.
Exactly. It's so important to think about prevention. One issue is that for things like disaster risk reduction, you don't always get the funding until these things become a big crisis. So we certainly look to the international community and to Catholics all over the world to think about preparing for these disasters before they get too bad.
I was speaking to Laura Sheehan, Communications Officer for Caritas Internationalis. Well, that's all for today from me, Susie Hodges, here at Vatican Radio's English programme. But we hope you have enjoyed listening to us. We'll be on the air again at the same time tomorrow. And don't forget, you can always find our programmes at the click of a mouse on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. Laudato Jesus Christus.